I'm pretty hard to fool, so I have no issue meeting with the executives, even if I know they're lying to me and they're trying to manipulate me. It's really about understanding all of that.
Payment and Banking, der Podcast aus der Mitte der Fintech- und Payment-Branche.
Auf den nächsten Programmpunkt habe ich mich ganz besonders gefreut. Und das soll gar nicht das schmälern, was wir bisher gesehen haben oder despektierlich wirken. Aber wir haben mal wieder einen mehr oder weniger Stargast zu Gast. Den meisten Menschen wird sie vor allem bekannt sein, weil sie maßgeblich dazu beigetragen hat, die, sagen wir mal, Causa Wirecard aufzudecken. Sie hat eigenmächtig recherchiert und frühzeitig gegen den Abschluss dieses Unternehmens gewettet. Aber auch schon vor der ganzen Sache Wirecard legte sie als Forbes 30 Under 30 eine steile Karriere hin. Sie wurde 2015 mit einer Short-Attacke gegen den US-Pharmakonzern Valeant berühmt und mit dieser Attacke löste sie oder deckte sie maßgeblich diesen Skandal auf mit auf. Netflix setzte ihr dann mit der Serie Dirty Money direkt ein Denkmal. Und mittlerweile betreibt sie ihren eigenen Hedgefonds namens Safkat Capital, angelehnt an eine ägyptische Gottheit. So viel zu ihr, aber wir haben natürlich noch einen tollen Gast, der gleich auch die Moderation übernehmen wird. Philipp Klöckner, nicht zu verwechseln mit seinem Kollegen Philipp Glöckner, mit dem er zusammen den Doppelgänger Tech Podcast betreibt. Ja, er ist sozusagen in digitalen Geschäftsmodellen zu Hause, unter anderem bei dem Shoppingportal Idealo und bei Rocket Internet zu Hause gewesen. Er lenkte für die Somner Brother das internationale Marketing und ist außerdem Investor und Advisor und hat natürlich auch schon mit zig Unicorns zusammengearbeitet. Fahmi, do you hear, do you see us?
Yes, thanks for having me. I'm sorry I can't be there in person.
Yeah, we are also sorry, but we are so glad that you joining the banking exchange this year. So I did not want to talk so long and I head over to Philipp and thank you for being with us.
Visa unterstützt aktuell den Podcast von Payment and Banking. Das globale Technologieunternehmen Visa ist weltweit führend, wenn es um digitales Bezahlen geht. Visas Ziel ist es, die Welt mit dem innovativsten, zuverlässigsten und sichersten Bezahlnetzwerk zu verbinden. Und das in mehr als 200 Ländern und Regionen mit globalen und lokalen Kooperationspartnern. Das VisaNet ist eine offene Plattform für Banken, Fintechs und viele weitere Partner. Hier entwickeln alle gemeinsam die Payment-Innovationen von morgen. Die digitale Geldbörse im Smartphone, aus dem Auto heraus bezahlen im Connected Car oder virtuell unterwegs mit Kryptowährungen? Visa ist mehr als eine Plastikkarte. Visas Anspruch ist es, die besten technologischen Lösungen zu entwickeln, um zu bezahlen und bezahlt zu werden. Für jeden und überall.
Welcome, Fahmi. It's our pleasure to have you today. Let's start really simple. So, traditional investors buy a stock in order to sell it later, making a profit. Short sellers sell a stock in order to buy it later with a discount. Why is the one seen as less benevolent or even harmful by some people, especially in Europe? What do you think, why that is?
Yeah, I don't even know if it's necessarily a European phenomenon, but generally human nature is that we want to see companies succeed and we want businesses to do well over time. And a consequence of that is generally people want to see the stock markets go up over time, and they always do. But that doesn't mean that individual stocks will always go up. I think the mantra these days is that stocks only go up, but that simply isn't true. The stock market serves as a way to effectively price assets. And part of that is taking into account fundamentals of business, how they perform, how they will grow in the future. And you can obviously have different objective opinions on what that looks like. So if you think a company is overpriced based on the analysis you've conducted, you can make a bet against those businesses. So there's buyers and sellers in the market, and that's what makes a market. And short sellers are just another investor on one side of the trade.
But if the market as a whole, like the CEOs, the shareholders, the analysts, the banks, the retail investors decide to engage in this consensual hallucination that they want stocks to always go up, why do short sellers have to come in and pee into the bonfire every single time. What's the merit of that, or the benefit for the society as a whole?
So if we want to believe that capitalism is one of the main drivers of innovation and economic success over the past few centuries, then you have to understand that capitalism is about effectively allocating capital. And the amount of capital, though these days it may feel like such, is not infinite. There is a finite pool of capital, and we should be effectively allocating that capital towards businesses that are going to progress society, that will make advancements, and that will benefit all of us. And we should not be allocating capital to those businesses that are committing fraud or crime or are hurting the broader public. So that's really what capitalism is about. That's what short selling is about. It's about ensuring that the limited capital we have is going to the right businesses so that we can make sure those businesses that need the support to help all of us get the resources that they need.
Yeah. So speaking of efficient capital allocation, we've seen this year Wall Street Bets, like a larger movement of young investors kind of targeting short sellers and their short positions by provoking short squeezes, gamma squeezes, investing in stocks that you wouldn't think are the best use of our kind of societal capital. Has that made your jobs, and we've seen some short sellers like leaving the market, Andy Left is one of them. Has that made your job significantly more risky or complicated, or can you adapt to that in some way?
It's never fun to be in a market which feels like it's in a race to the bottom, where all we're concerned about is making the most amount of money in the shortest amount of time. And it's this idea of diamond hands and holding on. And if we will it, if we want it, if we hold on long enough, stocks will go to the moon. And this is, it's dangerous behavior. It's very clear behavior that's shows up in any mania. So you look historically, from the Crusades to the various bubbles we've seen, like the tulip mania, South Sea bubble, and then look at what's happening today. And though obviously there are different factors involved here between the pandemic, the amount of liquidity that's in the system, the overall macroeconomic conditions, regardless of that, the behaviors are really similar. It's everyone is buying into this religion that stocks only go up. But the thing about religion and why the big religions have been successful over time is that they are offering people something that is lasting, something that is lasting past even our own existence. Whereas this religion of Wall Street Bets and diamond hands is about just offering short-term profit. And if you think about, if you've ever done a deal with anyone, if you've ever performed due diligence on a company, when someone promises you profit, promises you that you're going to make money, that is an immediate sign of fraud. Yet somehow, because of this collective delusion, this mania that we find ourselves in, people just buy in. People want to believe. And slowly but surely, people will start to lose their religion as some of the lowest hanging fruit, as far as the lowest quality businesses in the market, start to fall, and people start to lose money. And then they'll realize that we've all just sort of convinced ourselves of something that is never going to be possible. So it certainly makes my job difficult because it's disheartening to see what's going on in the markets. And it's hard, there's so much uncertainty. While I know this can't continue forever, and history has told us it can't continue forever, I have no idea what's going to stop it. And anyone who claims they have some sense or some idea of how it ends, I wouldn't believe them. But we've generally steered clear of these Wall Street Bets companies. Wall Street Bets has been around way before the pandemic, and Bloomberg had profiled Wall Street Bets even before these GameStop phenomenons. And for that period, there was actually a decent amount of analysis that was ongoing within that forum on Reddit, and people doing meaningful and thoughtful analysis. And in fact, over time, we had seen that many of the companies that we were short were actually being proposed as shorts on Wall Street Bets. But I think what a lot of institutional allocators with a lot of money have realized is that they can control, they can corner markets because the way the options market has gotten so important at this point, they realize that they can manufacture what they call these gamma squeezes, where big money, big investors with lots of money to throw around can go into a situation that may be heavily shorted, and they can start purchasing out of the money call options, and they can continue buying these. And then what happens is that the dealer who's selling you these options has to hedge in case they have to pay out on those options. So what happens then? It just squeezes higher, regardless of how much short interest. It's just a really disgusting, is the only word for it. It's a disgusting market inefficiency that's been exposed as we see higher and higher amounts of leverage in the market and this greater volumes going into out of money call options. And it creates a really disturbing dynamic, but we've mostly avoided the biggest of those gamma squeezes because we're so focused simply on companies we believe are committing fraud or engaged in bad behavior. More recently, we unfortunately did see one. We were part of a gamma squeeze in a company that's a for-profit prison operator here in the States. And the interesting thing with these for-profit prisons is that they are structured as real estate investment trusts, so they're not taxed. With the Biden administration, there has been a rolling back of these contracts for these for-profit prisons. There's going to be no new contracts in the future. So this non-taxable status will now be lost. And the companies even said that they're going to have to reevaluate their tax status, and they're likely going to have to consider bankruptcy. And somehow you have a bunch of, let's say, deep value investors that were long these for-profit prison operators, and then they suddenly find themselves stuck. They're stuck in the position, and then you can clearly see that the options are those call options are being bought, and then suddenly one day the thing is up 60%. It went down just as quickly, of course, but these are things we now have to be much more observant about. So we're much more keen at looking at what does the options volume look like around these names, and then just appropriately adjusting our position size so we can withstand that kind of volatility.
Got it. And one of the reasons you are kind of facing that much risk is because Safcat Capital is a concentrated short-only fund. That means, you're ready to invest up to 20-25% of the fund into single names, and short-only means you're not hedging against the market. That means you're basically not insuring your performance against the general market performance, which obviously is super risky. I mean, kind of what's wrong with you? Isn't running a hedge fund hard enough already?
Well, I really don't have much interest in running a hedge fund outside of running this very specific strategy of shorting stocks. It's the process of making money by going after bad actors that really motivates me. So it's not as though I ever, looked up to guys like Warren Buffett and said, I want to be this long-term value investor and I want to find big businesses that I can get in at the ground up and invest over time and compound. No, I found a way to make money doing what I really enjoy. And it just so happens to be through a hedge fund structure where my primary responsibility is making money for my investors. So that being said, I try to minimize the headaches and to keep things very focused on a concentrated set of names without any concern for what's going on in the market or hedging for those sort of external factors means that I can do the best job possible on diving deep into those businesses and getting a handle and becoming an expert in those businesses and making sure that I can deliver big when the time is right. And what we've seen in the past year, short sellers writ large are having difficult times. They can be running a book of 5 to 10 names like we do, or they could be running a book of 100 to 200 names. And they're still facing the same problems because it's not as though idiosyncratic factors within specific issuers is what's causing underperformance of short strategies. It's simply we're up against impossible market conditions. So in some ways, if I had a book of 100 names or 200 names on the short side, it would be even more difficult, because how am I supposed to be able to allocate resources effectively to understand, you know, that 100 set of names so that I can really make the best decisions as far as how do I size these positions? How do I predict when we might make money? So it's a lot easier to make those very informed decisions when you have a smaller group of stocks that you're trading around.
Got it. And like you said already, that you're only kind of betting against companies that are either fraudulent or engaging in criminal activity or relying on predatory business models. You were also vocal about having a short position in Tesla. Which of the three do you think the company is engaging in?
So we already know that there is some level of financial misrepresentation and financial and accounting shenanigans at Tesla. And then you add to that the business model that's been popularized by Silicon Valley, and it's very, it's emblematic of late stage capitalism, where we have these founder CEOs who have ultimate power, and shareholders give all of their power away to these executives, and these executives have no checks and balances. They have disproportionate amount of voting rights, and they surround themselves with a board of directors that will only say yes to whatever they do. And anyone who doesn't toe the line gets thrown out. So Tesla is a picture child of everything that's wrong with where we are with capitalism and where we are with capital markets. That being said, I never saw it as a huge conviction position because there are so many eyes on Tesla. You know, anyone who considers themselves a short seller has done some form of analysis on Tesla and has taken these positions. So for me to now enter the situation, unless I have some new edge and a new angle that we can research and get a hook on and develop conviction, then it's very hard for me to have conviction in a Tesla short position. That being said, we were short back in 2008 when the financial pressure was real. There was the idea that rates were going to go up, and suddenly Tesla was up against a much shorter runway. And it was clear they were already up against financial problems and distress, and they weren't paying their vendors. They were having issues actually getting together a real supply chain, a supply chain that's appropriate for an auto manufacturer. And they were up against these difficulties where it wasn't clear if they would ever be able to get additional capital to keep this going. But they did. They were able to access capital markets and get more debt. And at that point, we took our profits on the short and covered. But we continue monitoring the situation. Historically, businesses can't go on forever not making money, especially when they are in such an innovative field. There's the disadvantage of being a first mover. So though as a first mover, you're likely to get the brand recognition early, and you're able to get market share early. But over that period, many of your competitors who may have been much more established can take their time. They can be more patient about being thoughtful about how they enter the market. They are watching exactly everything you do. They're watching the cars that you make, and they're improving on the processes that you've already set out on. So it only gets more difficult for these first movers over time in the space like electric vehicles. There's a whole bunch of conditions that could make Tesla attractive for a short seller, but it's for me right now, we don't necessarily have that hook that would give us the conviction that we would need to take a big position there.
What makes a difference between a potential short candidate, and I mean, there might be hundreds of companies you're looking at, and then getting the timing right or getting to the conviction kind of at the right point in time to then start building a position against the company? Like, what's the typical inflection point or catalyst moment? And especially as you're not releasing your own research, so you can't catalyze the decline yourself. Like, how do you meet that timing decision usually?
Well, the process is really about keeping our head down and doing the work. So though we may only be short 5 to 10 names at any given time, over the past 4 years, we have been actively following over 100 names where we are always refreshing our information, our knowledge, our analysis in the context of whatever new is happening, because we're always trying to find that right opportunity. And we're always looking at that pipeline of ideas versus what's in the portfolio to reassess what is a more timely opportunity. But you know, how do we get to a catalyst? When we have a position that is, let's say, 25% of the book, it's because we have information that is actionable. And that likely will mean that we're able to provide this information to authorities and they are actively working on that information. And it's a high priority sort of investigation. So we would expect things to move very quickly. We can also have high conviction around certain events where our analysis will show that the fundamentals of the business have deteriorated to a point where there's no more covering it up. So there are catalysts that we can create, even though we don't publish any research. It's really about making sure we have good information that could eventually be the basis for indictments and the like and prosecutions. So that's one way of looking at it. But then it's trying to look through the fundamentals of the business itself, looking through the financials, and through that, trying to find a catalyst in their numbers. Because there's things as simple as, you know, there's only a certain amount of leverage that certain businesses can take on, because we don't just look at the equity, we're looking at the credit. So if we are looking through the credit agreements and trying to align what the covenants on the debt are with what the company is reporting, and we try to time things that way. There's sometimes journalists will either approach us for help on an investigation or vice versa. But that's a softer, it's a softer catalyst, because we don't ever know if they're actually going to publish on the things that we present. But depending on our confidence level in this catalyst occurring, whether it's some story that's going to come out, a lawsuit that might be in progress, something that's going to happen in their fundamentals that the company will have to report, whether authorities are going after them, depending on our confidence level, that's how we'll size the position. So if we have confidence, high confidence of something major happening in the short term, those are the instances where we take very large positions. So it's not like we will sit around on a 25% position for a year or even a couple of months. It's really, we try to be flexible about how we size things based on the information flow that we're basing our decisions on.
Yeah, and I think one of those positions where you had a very high conviction was the German Wirecard bank. And you correct me if I'm wrong, but you shared your research with the German regulator BaFin, which in hindsight reacted quite poorly with regards to that. And you've now have been kind of inquired as a witness in the parliamentary inquiry. By now and in hindsight, kind of, have you found your peace with the German regulatory framework, or do you see like larger misincentives or misalignments, like a more general critic?
Well, I would say corruption is a problem everywhere. And it's a problem in the States. It's a problem in Germany. It's a problem throughout. You know, we like to say it's an emerging market problem, but it's also a developed markets problem. But it just appears in more subtle ways. So in this case, and what we saw with how involved the Munich prosecutor was in ensuring that the short selling ban was put in place and going after the Financial Times, and basically ensuring investigations didn't actually go through and they weren't pursued, it's that you can't claim ignorance. The public prosecutor is not naive. They were fully aware of the goings on. And that's sort of what emboldened Wirecard. The reason that they were able to act so unscrupulously and they were able to get so large and make such brazen decisions was because they had the confidence that they were never going to get caught. Because they did get caught so many times and no one did anything about it. They might get called out one day and then the next day everyone's forgotten. And that when you take a set of egos, that they're very arrogant. They may have sociopathic tendencies. When you give them these sets of circumstances, then they are going to take that to the extreme. And that's really what happened here. But I don't want to say it's strictly a German problem. As far as money laundering, I think this is something that comes to the headlines in Germany far too often. And it was also very concerning to me that the German establishment, including the Ministry of Finance, did not admit that Wirecard was a money laundering case until a year after the fact. So I was heartened by the parliamentary inquiry into Wirecard. I think a lot of those MPs, specifically in the opposition, they really have taken this seriously, and it'll be interesting to see what the results are and what's done to prevent cases like this in the future. And even some of the cultural changes that are being made at BaFin, bringing in Mark Branson, I think that's also really commendable. So I'm, of course, rooting for Germany. I think this was such a shock. It was such a shock because of how adamantly the establishment insisted that Wirecard was a clean business. And many Germans lost money. Who lost more money than German investors in this? I think all of that has created a reckoning moment in German politics, in German markets. And I am optimistic. I'm optimistic about the changes that are taking place.
Such a broad coalition of forces rising was being stacked against you. Like the press was very negative. There was a whole lobbying campaign going on. The prosecutors were against short sellers. Does this like even increase your conviction usually, or do you start getting second thoughts and kind of double checking your own data, etc.?
Well, in some ways, it does at least show us that we're onto something when there's this whole ecosystem that exists almost just to protect Wirecard. So in that sense, of course, we knew we were onto something, but that doesn't necessarily mean we can have conviction in the short. Because at the end of the day, we need to be able to make money for our investors. And that means that we need to find a way around the fact that these guys were being protected and there was such a case of willful blindness that was going on in Germany. So we really needed to reevaluate the case altogether. We needed to understand what the crimes were that were being committed, where were they occurring, and who has a vested interest in seeing those crimes prosecuted. And after my experience with BaFin, and you know, in fact, I was in Frankfurt, and even then they refused to meet with me. It just seemed very clear to me that we weren't going to get anything done. And historically, Germany has never really been proactive on issues of money laundering. And for that reason, we went with the U.S. Authorities. U.S. authorities have a priority on money laundering, particularly following the Magnitsky Act, and they've been rolling out numerous sanctions, especially on Russian oligarchs. So this would be something that would be investigative priority for the U.S. And we felt that the information that we had was certainly strong enough for them to take us seriously on the matter.
Many other short sellers and journalists have reported they've been followed and investigated themselves during the Wirecard process. Have you experienced any virtual or physical threats that you got aware of?
Yeah, so even before I launched SoftKet, which was January of 2018, We had started our research process on a number of names, one of them being Wirecard. And part of that research process, I had filed a Freedom of Information Act request, so a request for public records from the government relating to Wirecard. And those requests are eventually made public. So Wirecard must have gotten a hold of those records and saw that my name was on there and assumed that I was investigating them and assumed that I was short. And from then on, I was up against, you know, huge cyber surveillance, phishing, hacking, before I even really realized quite what was going on. I just knew I was being targeted. I wasn't absolutely positive that it was Wirecard until it became pretty clear based on some of the emails that they were faking and that I was receiving. But this only, you know, escalated over time, obviously, as I was getting deeper into the network and I was understanding what was going on and I was sort of embedding myself in the high-risk payment space to see things for myself. And as I got closer and closer to the masterminds of the whole operation, that's when things started to escalate. And eventually this culminated back in January of 2020, where I was physically assaulted outside of my home, you know, in broad daylight. It was a week after I had provided, you know, a big load of information to U.S. authorities. And it was clear that that's a professional job relating to the information I was giving on Wirecard and their friends.
So, Jerry, we're happy to still have you here, or the chance to have you. One question. Last week, I've read that you're not only a great short seller, you're also an expert in the pharmaceutical industry, as far as I know. And last week, I've read an article that the U.S. company Biogen got approval from the FDA, the U.S. regulator for food and drugs, for a drug that's supposed to help Alzheimer patients, which is called Aduhelm, which costs roughly $150 per day. However, the scientific committee or council of the FDA, which consists of 11 people, none of these 11 people were kind of recommending to approve the drug, and three people resigned after they've not been heard in that decision. Is that something that you would typically look at? Doesn't that feel a bit predatory if a drug that where there's no scientific proof for bettering the situation of patients at the cost of $150,000 per year, $50,000 per year, goes to market?
100% it's predatory. But to be frank, most of how the pharmaceutical industry operates in the U.S. is predatory, and how drugs are priced is predatory. And when I was saying that, you know, it's not just corruption in Germany, there's corruption here, we don't call it bribery, we call it lobbying. And these pharmaceutical companies spend millions of dollars. It's a significant part of their expenses in order to lobby for their drugs. And they ensure that they're surrounding themselves with scientists and, you know, key opinion leaders who will properly advocate for their drug to their colleagues, to their friends. And even though we don't really know if this drug works and the trials are still ongoing, and even the mechanism by which the drug acts has not, we still don't have necessarily a link between that mechanism and preventing any further harm from Alzheimer's or reducing or reversing the effects of Alzheimer's. We don't really know any of this yet. But we forever have given pharmaceutical businesses a free pass because everyone wants better drugs and we want innovation and we want to take care of our elderly and our children. And because of that, pharmaceutical companies are basically going around, and it's one of the only industries where you have 90% margins, if not higher. So there is a broader conversation to be had about how are we pricing drugs in the U.S., especially given a lot of the basic science that informs these drugs and allows these drugs to be possible is subsidized by U.S. taxpayers. So when we have a drug like Biogen's Alzheimer's treatment, perhaps we need to be more thoughtful about how we price it. You know, perhaps this means that no an insurance company is not paying upfront for that $56,000 a year annual cost, but rather is going to be paid based on clinical markers. So if there is improvement, then they will get paid. And I think that's more than fair enough. And the U.S. was already going in this direction of having this bigger discussion about drug pricing, and for these specialty drugs and that are super expensive, having a value-based pricing model. But now we have the pandemic, and in record time, the biggest pharmaceutical companies were able to come out with efficacious vaccines. And I think there isn't as much political will to aggressively pursue issues of drug pricing right now, because suddenly we're treating these pharmaceutical companies like gods again. But you know, this is a problem with American politics. It's hard for people to stay focused. It's like attention deficit disorder across the board. But you know, I regularly work with healthcare lobbyists, like patient advocates, who are suffering from these diseases and speaking for those with these diseases. And the one thing about U.S. politicians and congressmen and women is that they can refuse many meetings, but they can't refuse the meetings of patients who are ill, that are their constituents. So we're doing the hard work of making sure that something is done here. But 100% of the pricing on Biogen is a predatory situation. It remains to be seen how this actually plays out, and if we're able to do something that would be fairer for patients and everyone else in the system.
Thank you. Probably last question before we open the questions to the audience. Is there any event you can think of that would make you revise your short-only strategy that lets you go on the long side or engage in a short-long strategy?
Absolutely not. Just because I don't see myself as a long-short investor. I don't want to spend my time doing that. I really just love what I do on the short side, which is funny because sometimes finding longs, everyone likes to say it's so much easier than finding shorts. But the way it works, sometimes, you know, as I go through researching these companies and I find something that's, wow, that's actually a good business. Wow, that's operating ethically. I just tell my investors, hey, looked at this as a short, but maybe you want to go long. I'm not going long. But, you know, it's more just opportunistic like that. I don't see myself ever changing the business model.
How would your work and your life would look different if your fund would be, you're a very small team still. How would your work be different if your fund would be four or five times the size, you think? Could you investigate more companies, or would you like still take very concentrated positions then?
Yeah, absolutely. We would still be very concentrated. And the thing is, we target fairly liquid, you know, large cap businesses, many of them. So it's not as though we're capital constrained. So if we took another, you know, let's say $500 million, we could easily deploy that across the types of names that we already look at. But when we do get bigger, and you know, I'm sure we will. Right now, short selling is perhaps the least popular strategy out there, but that probably means it's one of the best times to get in. But either way, the resources would just go towards diving deeper, because it takes a lot of money to go and build up these cases, do the research, and then present those cases to regulators and others. That's capital intensive. So could that mean then that we don't just have one Wirecard situation? We are able to juggle a few of those big intensive type names at once? Totally possible. But I don't see the portfolio structure itself changing very much. I think we would still stay very focused. And even as far as the team, it would be small. Like the way I've envisioned it is that maybe we get to the point where we have, you know, five people on the team, and each individual, we all look at every name together, but each individual has a specific skill set that they can bring to the table when we're analyzing these businesses. So it'll always be very intimate. And another reason for that is that this is such a sensitive business. It's you're dealing with whistleblowers, you're dealing with crime, you're dealing with people's lives. And because of that, you really need to be careful of who you let into the room. So even just the thought of bringing on more people, it will take time. It'll take time to ensure there's the right cultural mix, and that they are fully aligned with the values we have at Softcat.
Got it. So last question, probably, like, I can make this a very personal one. I'm regularly doing due diligence work for private equity firms, and that's not that much different from doing short selling, just that I don't hire private investigators, etc. However, like, when I started doing that, I kind of rejected meeting the management of the company because I thought, like, they would start manipulating me, or I would start liking them or disliking them. That would kind of impede my judgment. What do you think is more important, looking at the numbers of a company or actually meeting management, talking to people, doing social engineering almost? What's your take on that?
So anyone can look at the numbers. And there's only so many ways that you can analyze financial statements and what you can extract from that and read between the lines. Where you can differentiate yourself is how do you place those financial statements and those numbers in the broader context of the business that's being operated here and the industry and the culture of that business. So what I've realized as someone was always rooted in numbers and rooted in what's technical, I've learned to embrace the softer side of things and understanding how people operate. Because it's never going to be the failure of a balance sheet itself that will bring a business down. It's the decisions that the executives will make around those issues of financial weakness. And when you can get into someone's head and you can try to understand, what are their values? How do they operate? What stresses them out? How do they operate under stress? Then you can get better at being a few steps ahead of them as far as with the moves that they will make. So I'm pretty hard to fool. So I have no issue meeting with the executives. Even if I know they're lying to me and they're trying to manipulate me, it's really about understanding all of that. What's the extent to which they're trying to manipulate me? Why are they doing this? How are they reacting? Will they look me in the eye? Will they engage with me politely, or will they make underhanded comments? All of this sort of factors in to understanding the bigger picture. Because in cases of systemic fraud, so where it's not just one lone wolf that does something wrong within a business, but it's sort of this rot that is throughout the organization, which is something we saw within multiple offices for Wirecard. It really is about understanding culture, and culture is all about people. So that is a huge part of differentiating our analysis from just, a basic sort of look at how the numbers are doing.
You just mentioned you're still getting better. I'm sure you've learned a lot when you've worked for Grant Savage. I'm sure raising your own fund was exciting and you've learned a lot. What is it that you're still learning kind of in the last year or this year?
Yeah, this is my biggest weakness. It's just that being able to accept what I can't control and what I don't have any certainty about. Because when your business and the way you're shorting stocks is so information driven, and everything is about becoming an expert and knowing everything inside and out and predicting things before they happen, what about when there's no certainty? It's complete uncertainty, and there's nothing that I can do to change the situation. I have no way to predict what's going to happen, and operating in those positions of uncertainty. That's, I think, the hardest part for any actor in the financial markets, because it's really about understanding what you know and then clearly understanding what you don't know. And I'm getting better at, of course, understanding what I don't know, but getting comfortable with what I don't know is definitely the harder part.
Thank you, Fahmi. Thank you for your honest answers and the insights. This was super interesting for me personally, but for the whole audience, I think. Nicole, welcome back on stage.
Thank you, Fahmy, also from my side, from the audience. Thank you for the personal insights in your work, the business market, your business model, what it means, hedge fund management, short selling, and the practice. Hopefully, we see you next year here on site. Maybe the traveling restrictions will be much more better then.
Yes, I look forward to it. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
You again. Yeah.
Best greetings from Germany to New York.